Session number 8655, Reel 1.
Mr. Weiberg, Reel 1. Can you tell me when you joined the army and why?
Well, when I was a student at London University, I joined the OTC. And then when war started in September 1939, I wrote to the OTC and said, what do we do now? And I was sent for, and I went to an interview, and then within a matter of a week or two, I found myself at the Officer Cadet Training Unit at Shorncliffe. And I was commissioned into the West Yorkshire Regiment in February 1940. I had nothing to do with Yorkshire at all, but when it came to deciding who went to which regiments, they simply had a list of cadets in alphabetical order alongside a list of regiments in alphabetical order. And as my name begins with W, so I went into the West Yorkshire Regiment.
So it was a random system?
Yes. The other cadet who came with me, his name was White.
Had you considered going into any other arm other than the infantry?
No. Not really. I think I was well satisfied at having got to Noctu at all, and I was content with that.
Where did you join the battalion?
Well, then I first of all went to the depot at York, and was only there a few weeks, and White and I were posted to the 2nd Battalion, which was then in Khartoum, and we went out as reinforcements.
How did you travel out there?
Well, it took a fortnight to get from York to Khartoum. We went by train to London. I lived in London, so I stayed overnight, and then I caught the train from Waterloo the next morning to Southampton. And we travelled that night to Cherbourg, where we spent a day, and that night we left by train, and we travelled right across France to Marseille. I think that took about a couple of days, very slow train. At Marseille, we got onto a boat called the Dilwara and travelled to Alexandria, where we got a train to Cairo. White and I had to stay in Cairo a couple of days because the trains going south left only twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. We then caught a train in the evening which travelled all night and then arrived at... The railway station was called Shalal, but it's near Aswan. There was, of course, already a dam at Aswan then. And there you get off the train and you get on the riverboat, which takes a couple of days, I think, to get to Wadi Halfa, which is on the Sudan border. And then you get back on a train, which, of course, is the railway that was originally built by Kitchener in 1898, whenever it was. And that takes, I don't know, one night, I suppose, we spend on that train to get to Khartoum.
Was it your first visit to the Middle East?
Yes.
What impression did Egypt make on you when you arrived there?
Well, when we got to Alexandria, it was a smell, really. It was a very, very distinct smell coming up from the docks, and I thought, my God, I don't think I can live with this. But, of course, I think you get used to smells quicker than anything else. And then, of course, it was quite hot. This was April, but it was quite hot in Cairo. When we got to Aswan, it was hotter still. And I remember getting out of the train. We were wearing Wolseley helmets. And as I got out of the train, the sun seemed to sort of hit you. And but then... after that, it was a question of dust, really. The dust, the sand, came into the train from Wadi Halfa to Khartoum all the time. It was rather sort of gritty everywhere. And desert, nothing to see. Very boring journey.
How did the Sudan compare to Egypt?
Well, there was not the... Of course, Egypt is the Nile Valley and the Nile Delta, which is very green, and Sudan doesn't have that. It has the Nile, but as you travel by riverboat in in Upper Egypt. It's very dry, never rains. There are these villages along the river banks, and just very dry, with a certain amount of vegetation right on the water's edge. The Sudan is just, the northern Sudan is just desert, really.
When you were in England in training, had you thought that you might be sent out to the Middle East?
No, I don't think I had. I think our thoughts were on the events of World War One, and the war hadn't started properly then. There was no real fighting going on. I just thought, well, I'd be sent to France or Belgium.
So you had some ideas then about the sort of strategy and tactics that might be employed?
Well, the tactics that we'd learnt at the Officer Cadet Training Unit, and that I'd learnt in the OTC and the Cadet Corps school, that sort of thing.
And what sort of tactics were they? Were they based on First World War?
Yes, they were. The Cadet Corps at school, I went to a grammar school. Grammar school had Cadet Corps. Public schools had OTCs. And yes, we were taught to be potential NCOs, and it was based on section leading with Lewis guns. And in the OTC, it was really map reading and that sort of thing. And at the OCTU, we certainly were taught how to put up barbed wire entanglements, such as they'd use on the Western Front in World War One.
What about political expectations? Did the outbreak of war come as a surprise to you?
No, it didn't. I don't think it surprised anybody. I'm not sure that I was necessarily expecting it to happen. In the OTC, people used to talk about when it comes, and some of them used to say, well, I'm going to join the RASC. I'm not going to be in the PBI, as we called it. And there was that sort of talk going on. I don't think I thought it was necessarily going to happen, but I wasn't surprised when it did. And when you're a young man, and the prospect of adventure is quite exciting.
Did you ever consider Italy as a potential enemy?
No. They changed sides in World War One, hadn't they? I don't think we knew what they were going to do in World War Two. I don't remember that we thought about them very much. I think Mussolini didn't have the impact on one that Hitler had. He was a sort of operatic type of figure, whereas Hitler was much more menacing, I think.
When you got out to Khartoum, how did the battalion receive you?
Well, very well. At that time, this was April 1940, it was a regular battalion. I think White and I were only the third and fourth wartime subalterns to join. And, of course, all army officers in those days were ex-public school boys, and I wasn't, and I felt this a little bit, that there was this difference. But I was very extremely well-treated. No complaints at all.
Was White an ex-public school
boy? Yes, he was.
What did they do with you, then, when you arrived?
Well, I was posted to a rifle company and given command of a platoon. In those days, they had a rank called platoon sergeant major. They were warrant officers, class 2. And I suppose they were... it was instituted because of the shortage of junior officers to take command of platoons. So that... I was given command of a platoon in place of another subaltern who was moved to command, I think, the carrier platoon. And the other two platoons were commanded by platoon sergeant majors.
So the West Yorkshires were short of platoon commanders, were they?
Well, they were, if you're going to expect every platoon to be commanded by an officer, which I think they expected this would happen as more wartime officers became available. But, of course, it never did. And when the rank of platoon sergeant major was abolished, fairly soon afterwards. After that, platoons were frequently commanded by sergeants.
Did that system work well?
I think it did, because these sergeants who were given command of platoons were soldiers of considerable experience. They would have been men who had been in the army before the war. They were all either still in the army when the war broke out, or if they'd come back from the reserve. And they were steeped in sort of the way the army worked, the system, and it was no real difficulty for them to command a platoon, really, because they were so used to the system.
So how many officers were there in your particular company?
Oh, just the company commander and myself.
There's no two IC there?
No.
And were the other companies on a similar scale?
Yes. Except, of course, headquarter company, which had the specialist platoons like signals, mortars, carriers, and they were all commanded by officers.
What about other ranks? Was the battalion up to strength in those?
I think it probably was in Khartoum at that time, because it had received quite large reinforcements of reservists already. But I would say it was probably I think 90 or more percent regulars when I first joined.
These reserves you mentioned, were they regular reserves who'd been called back to the colours?
That's right. Yes.
So you didn't have any conscripts?
I don't think there were any conscripts at that time, no.
How many men were there in your platoon?
Well, the strength was about 30. I think, yes, about 30.
And how were they organised?
In three sections, each section commanded by a corporal. And each section was armed with a Bren gun.
And presumably you had a sergeant?
Oh, yes, there was a platoon sergeant who was second in command of the platoon, if there was an officer commanding it, or if there was a platoon sergeant major commanding it.
And were they all Yorkshiremen?
Yes, almost all of them were Yorkshiremen then, West Yorkshiremen.
And how did you get on with them?
Oh, quite well. When I first joined the regiment at York, of course, I was given a command of a platoon there. And at first I couldn't understand a word any of them said, because they had very broad accents, but you get used to it. And also, the men get used to modifying their accent when talking to an officer who is not a Yorkshireman. So, yes, one got on with them very well, really. I don't think the fact that one came from different parts of the country made any difference.
When you got your platoon at Khartoum, how long did it take you to achieve full and confident control of them?
Well, in Khartoum, living in barracks and with desert just around, there wasn't much opportunity to have your platoon and actually do something with it as a whole. The men were very much on fatigue duties and guard duties. And as the only other officer in the company, I had to stand in for the company commander on certain occasions when he wasn't there. And after war with Italy broke out in June, we had to have these posts in the desert around Khartoum, and they had to be visited. And I used to do that quite a lot. So I really combined the tasks of second in command of the company and platoon commander, until in July my company was sent off to a place called Gedaref, which is on the railway, and therefore was an important place. It was a fairly large native town. By this time I think the Italians had captured Kassala, which is just over the border into the Sudan from Eritrea, and Galabat, which is just over the border from Abyssinia. And to what extent the general thought that they might penetrate the Sudan even further, I don't know. But anyway, we were sent to Gedaref just in case. And then we were there, we had to have organise defensive positions. And that was the first time, really, that I had the platoon as a whole to organise on a sort of basis of fighting, you know, of combat.
And had you got to know them all as individuals by that stage?
Oh, yes, yes.
Did it take you any time to get settled in and feel at home in the battalion, or did that happen very quickly?
No, it took some time. I don't think I really felt at home until the whole battalion arrived at Galabat, and we were all there, and each of us, we were all engaged in various little minor engagements, and one began to feel that one was, I began to feel that I was, you know, a functioning member of the unit.
So are you saying then that before that, things have been going on have been too fragmented to really create the impression of being part of a team?
Yes.
You mentioned the outbreak of war with Italy. How was the news of that received?
Well, we used to talk about the balloon going up, and eventually the balloon went up, and nothing happened. It was really like the outbreak of war in England. Nothing happened straight away, and nothing happened there straight away. The outward visible signs were that we stopped putting dinner jackets on in the evening to have dinner. We just wore uniform all the time and sidearms. And the men carried their rifles everywhere they went.
Did you have any briefing from battalion headquarters or higher up about what the commencement of hostilities meant?
Not that I
have to do.
Not that I recall.
Were you in touch with what was going on in the wider world while you were at Khartoum? Did you get newspapers or broadcasts or?
Yeah, well, yes, we got information because the fall of France occurred whilst we were in Khartoum, and I can remember thinking that, you know, wondering what was going to happen and wondering, thinking we might be stuck in Khartoum forever. If Germany, if there was an invasion, if the Germans invaded Britain, what was going to become of us? Sort of cut off in Khartoum, we might be there for years and years, and how awful that would be.
But was there any idea that the Italians might advance further in from Kassala and...
Yes, it was always a possibility. I don't think it was taken terribly seriously. It posed considerable problems for them because of the country over which they would have to advance. And communications by... there was a railway in the Sudan, but the roads were very poor. And they would have been very exposed if they had advanced across the desert into the interior of the Sudan.
Had you had any intelligence summaries on the Italian army and its characteristics and capabilities?
Yes. I was sent on an intelligence course to Cairo sometime during the summer of 1940. And we were given quite a lot of information about the organisation of the Italian army.
What sort of things did they tell you about it?
Well, the names of the ranks and the organisation of the units and that sort of thing. I don't recall a great deal of it now, I'm afraid.
Do you remember whether, in the event, it proved to be fairly accurate?
I think so, yes. I don't think there was much secrecy about the Italian army. I think quite a lot was known about it.
Did this course discuss anything of the Italian tactics and strategy?
No, not that I remember.
It was basically organisation
yes.
and equipment and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, that's right. And it's sort of small engineering work, such as how they would build bridges over canals and that sort of thing.
Did this course train you as an intelligence officer?
I think that was the idea, but I never became an intelligence officer.
Now, you made some reference to putting posts around Khartoum.
Yes.
What was the purpose of these posts?
Difficult to say, because I can't imagine that the Italians would have got as far as the outskirts of Khartoum without us knowing that they were on their way. I think they must have been to give warning of the approach of enemy aircraft.
And how were they deployed? Were they in a ring all the way around Khartoum?
Yes, there would be posts, and consisting probably of one section at each post, and then there would be one man on sentry.
And how far from Khartoum were they?
Oh, out in the desert, just beyond the built-up part, no distance.
Were they dug in, or in a defensive layout?
No. I don't think it would have been possible to have had a dug-in defensive position of Khartoum. The area was much too big for the number of troops available.
But the posts presumably could have been dug in.
Dug in they may have been, I don't remember.
You don't recall if they had slip trenches or anything?
No,
like that.
I don't recall that.
What was Khartoum like as a place to live in, as a city?
Well, it was very hot in the summer. It was exceedingly hot. But there were amenities. The officers used to go to the club, which had a swimming pool and a bar where you could sit and drink beer if you wanted to. There were one or two restaurants in the town which could be visited. There was a library. There was the river. You could walk along the river bank if it wasn't too hot. One of the troubles was that there was a brothel area which was out of bounds to the troops, but nevertheless they used to go there and get venereal disease quite often. And I was told by my company commander once to go and visit the men of the company who were in the hospital. And I was going round saying, "How are you? Are you getting better?" And they were sort of saying yes and smiling at me, because they realised that I didn't realise what they were in there for.
What else could they do when they were off duty? Was there any other recreation?
Well, they had to amuse themselves in barracks. The barracks were quite comfortable. And then they could go into the town and have drinks. And I think that's how they used to arrive at the brothels. I think they went out with the intention of going out for the evening, visiting a cafe and having a few drinks. But then, of course, having had a few drinks, that's the point at which they might decide to go to the brothel area, which was out of bounds.
Were they subject to disciplinary action if they went to the brothel area?
Yes, they were. And we had a provost sergeant who used to go round that area with some men of his section. And he would go into the brothels, and if he found a man in there, he would put him on a charge, and he would be brought up in front of his company commander, who would remand him for the CO, and he would be brought up in front of the CO. And there was a little joke in the battalion about this, because this provost sergeant had to give evidence in each case and used to describe how he was on patrol in the brothel area, that he went into this particular house and he saw this man lying on a bed, and he would always conclude his evidence by saying he was naked. And this was supposed to clinch the evidence as to what the man was in there for. And this was quite a little joke in the battalion. He was naked.
What sort of sentence would he get for being found naked in a brothel?
I think he'd probably get 14 days confined to barracks.
What was the state of discipline like generally, apart from this tendency to go off into the red light district?
Well, I think it was quite good, because these men were all regular soldiers who had originally joined the army voluntarily for a variety of reasons, of course, unemployment or unhappy at home and that sort of thing. But they were used to discipline. It was part of life to them. And I don't think it was very much insensitive to break out and be different from all the others.
Were they generally content to be in the Sudan?
It wasn't one of the best stations for the army. They had come from Palestine, as it was then called, which would have been a much more, a much pleasanter place to be in. I think we all thought Khartoum was, because of the heat mainly, wasn't the best station to be in. And I think we were all very glad to get away from it.
How did they respond to the news that you were going forward down to Gadarif?
Well, I think they responded quite well, because I think we all thought, well, it's a change. You see, we got on a train. We went to Gadarif by train from Khartoum. It was a train ride. It was somewhere different. Gadarif was a different sort of place because it was a native town. There weren't very many brick buildings, and it was a bit greener than it wasn't quite the bare desert that surrounded Khartoum. I think we all regarded it as a nice change.
What sort of accommodation did you have down there?
I think we must have had tents. There was no permanent barracks or anything like that. And the natives mostly lived in these sort of brick mud huts with straw roofs.
You mentioned the native town. How did you get on with the native population?
One didn't come into contact with them very much. The one shop in Gadarif was actually run by Greeks. We met the district commissioner, who had his headquarters in Gadarif, and the company commander and myself, and by this time we had a second in command of the company who was had been a company sergeant major in the battalion, who had been commissioned as a lieutenant. And the district commissioner used to invite the three of us to dinner sometimes. And he was there on his own, and he always fell asleep over the suite. I think this was the effect of the heat in the day, and then the food. Probably we had a few drinks before dinner, but I remember quite regularly he fell asleep over the suite, but not for very long. He woke up again quite quickly.
What about the troops? Were they generally on reasonable terms with the Sudanese?
Oh, yes, in Khartoum, I think the Sudanese, the shopkeepers welcomed them because they had a certain amount of money to spend. And the Sudanese, they're black, but they're very well-mannered, they're very dignified people, and quite proud people, and quite clean, really. I think there was quite a good relationship between the Khartoum townsfolk and the British troops. In Gadarif, of course, the Sudanese were more primitive, and I doubt whether the troops had any contact with them at all.